Area Stratigraphy have been rebuffed?
Not universally. I mean, there are members of the subcommission who have been open in entering into a dialogue. My primary, almost single goal is to make that proposal on Crawford Lake as comprehensive and as compelling as possible, and leave it to the Subcommission on Quaternary to read it, judge it on the scientific merits, not on prejudice against what is in stratigraphy definitely an outlier. I mean, if you're looking at people who've come to this conference looking at living corals and, you know, 15.6 centimeter thick varve unit is not what they're normally, you know, used to. It's not part of their wheelhouse.
They're looking at things that go back 50 million or 100 million or
billions of years. Yes, exactly. So it is a challenge for stratigraphers to view this as legitimate stratigraphy. I understand that.
But stratigraphy deals with deep history and hard rock and not recent time.
But stratigraphy deals with all geologic time, and we are living in geologic time now. So whether there is an Anthropocene or we continue to be in the Holocene, we're still in an interval of geologic time. So what it's a question of whether there is substantial evidence in the geologic record, the rock record, of a shift in Earth systems that is a change in Earth's history, the way the Earth behaves, whether that is sufficient to merit a line on the time scale and a new name. That's a scientific question. It shouldn't be muddled with prejudice about, well, that's not really stratigraphy, it's only 73 years, it's not even rock. They're not incorrect, but they do not actually address the merits of the stratigraphic merits of what we have presented. The Anthropocene Working Group has presented, to the best of its ability, very good candidates, amongst which it was difficult to come to a conclusion. But there were several very good candidates that show clear stratigraphic evidence of a substantial change in the Earth that far exceeds anything that happened in the last 11,700 years. So
the Anthropocene is it's an Earth systems concept.
That's where it originated.
And that's where it originated. And here you've got geologists who are not Earth scientists. There, I guess they are. I mean, some layperson would think, heck, a geologist, somebody who studies rock, studies science.
Yes.
But Earth systems science is quite a distinct discipline.
Yeah.
And obviously the Anthropocene idea has been embraced much more warmly by Earth system scientists and by the geologists who traditionally look at things that go back billions of years.
Right, and that's the thing. We have an upstart group of Earth scientists who are looking at the planet as an integrated group of subsystems that interact and depend on one another and are perturbed. And there are people who are Earth system scientists, or people at agencies like NOAA, for instance, who are interested in predicting things that are societally important, like flooding, El Nino events, drought, etc. So that group of scientists who use, supercomputers and physics models, as well as an understanding of the Earth from a geological perspective, have on their own come to the conclusion that the interval since 1950 is the valid point of reference for any projections into the future. So their job is to plan for public safety, etc. So they don't even worry about what the stratigraphers think. They are going to continue to use 1950 as the point of reference. The question is whether the stratigraphers want to adhere to their very strict views on what should and shouldn't be an interval of geologic time is stratigraphy. So whether they want to adhere to their very, very strict, rigid interpretation of what constitutes geologic time and the record thereof, or if they want to, if they're willing to expand their concept to allow what the Anthropocene Working Group has worked very hard to, in as much as it's possible, to slot something that started in the mid-20th century into the way that stratigraphic practice is undertaken, that we have done everything possible to do that. So whether they're willing to meet us halfway is, I think, the question.
You were mentioning yesterday that the most of the cores that you've pulled out from the bottom of Crawford Lake have been consumed.
Yes.
In the course of testing them.
Absolutely.
Which is really interesting. There is one core that's been maintained. Can you talk about this
briefly?
Right.
Actually, right now, because we returned in April of 2023, there are two cores currently in cryogenic facilities at the National Museum in Canada, the Canadian Museum of Nature, and the Royal Ontario Museum. So there have been two since 2022. Now there are, at Carleton University, I believe we have three left. We have plans for one of those to be archived at the Canadian Museum of Nature, the one from which some of the plutonium analysis was performed at annual resolution. But the others are currently available for additional analyses that we're discussing best use, or just leave them there until technology improves, so that we there may be in future, you know, ways to do things non-destructively or whatever.
Will there be more cores pulled out? Is there more
not
research
in the near future
to do?
There's plenty more research to do, not in the near future. The Indigenous people for whom the site is sacred have a different worldview, and personhood is something they attach to the natural world. So to them, ongoing poking and prodding is invasive. And we made a case this year in 2023 that we, compelling case that to return and collect additional cores. We were granted permission, but it was made clear that in the near future, we were not to come back because we have enough information now to make the case scientifically, and the lake should be allowed to heal.
From all that poking and prodding and coring.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of like going to the gynecologist or something. Okay, give it a rest.
Francine McCarthy is a geologist at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, and a voting member of the Anthropocene Working Group. Read more about the Crawford Lake Golden Spike at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor, a listener-supported podcast. I'm David Kattenberg. McCarthy pays homage to the First Nations people who walked lightly on Crawford Lake shores, leaving the most benign of signatures in the lake's sediments, corn pollen. Today, the lake and its surroundings are owned and operated by Halton Region Conservation Authority, established under the Conservation Authorities Act of the Province of Ontario, but Crawford Lake sits on unceded lands of the Wyandot, Wendat, Attawandaron, Tianantate, and Wenro peoples. First Nations leaders granted permission for the lake's bottom sediments to be cored on various occasions. Now they want her to remain in peace and recover. Catherine Tomorrow is a seated Spotted Turtle Clan faith keeper and an artist living in Toronto. Her installations have appeared at exhibitions around the world, among these at the House of World Culture in Berlin, that helped fund the activities of the Anthropocene Working Group. I spoke with Catherine Tomorrow at her art studio in Cabbage Town, Toronto. What's your connection to Crawford Lake?
Crawford Lake sits in southern Ontario, of course, and is part of the homeland for the Wendat people. But it is also part of the homeland for the Attawandaron, the Tiononthate, and the Wenro, and several different peoples who existed in, who have existed in this space for forever. The Wendat, as they were dispersing, merged with the Tiononthate, or the Petun people. And those people reemerged along with the Wenro and the Attawandaron as the Wyandot in 1701 in Detroit. And then they had been to Michilimackinac. At some point they came across the border and settled in Windsor, and then later on, after the reserve here was disbanded, if you will, they went back down to Michigan. And that's where they're located now. But this is our homeland. Crawford Lake is very significant to me because I believe that this is the place where we began to be who we are. In other words, descendants of the Attawandaron, the Wendat, and the Tiononthate people. And then as we went further southwest, we merged with others as well. Quebec.
When did you go to Crawford Lake for the first time? When did you visit it for the first time?
Oh, I think it would probably be 2014. Catherine McGee LaBelle, the author of Daughters of Atensic, and the Women's Advisory Council met in Ontario to start our project about significant Wendat and Wyandot women. And we were there. We were in Toronto meeting, and we all just kind of said, well, why don't we just go up to Crawford Lake? Because Catherine had spent a great deal of time there in her childhood. And it was revolutionary for the women who were involved. They felt an incredible connection to the place. The chief, the principal chief of Kansas, Judith Manthe, speaks about it very emotionally, as she did at my opening at Crawford Lake, about how she felt a very deeply rooted connection to that space, and that she was in communion with her ancestors there. And I have felt the same connection. It's overwhelming, and it's also, I think, facilitated by the longhouses and supported by the people who are so wonderfully doing everything they can to put the Wendat, Attawandaron, Wyandot, you know, kind of piece forward, to bring that voice or our voices forward. And they're also working with other Indigenous communities because, of course, this is Treaty 13 territory, so they work with the Haudenosaunee, and I believe they're doing some work with the Mississaugas as well. So, but the space is Wendat space and Attawandaron space. The people lived there in layers at different times.
Tell me about Crawford Lake. What does it look like? What's it like there?
Sure. Well, you drive in. It's a park. It's a conservation area. So it was developed in the 60s after Hurricane Hazel to help control the watershed and the floodwater, potential floodwater situations. So they're water guardians, I suppose you could say, all of the people who work there. Very interested in protecting the lake, which is, I believe, a UNESCO site. It's protected. And very interested in preserving the natural flora and fauna of the space. But when you drive into the park, you immediately come upon the Deer Clan Longhouse, the Wolf Clan Longhouse, the Turtle Clan Longhouse, and the outline of another longhouse in posts, which I feel that they should call the Bear Clan Longhouse, because these are significant clans for the Wendat people, although all the clans are significant. So it is a village space which contains reconstructed longhouses on the footprints of the original longhouses that were there, remnants of which were uncovered in the late 70s. So I believe they started rebuilding them at about that time, and it's become a huge attraction for people because of the Miramictic Lake, which is also there, Crawford Lake itself, and also the Indigenous content. In terms of the longhouses, there's lots of educational opportunities. There are shows and lectures and presentations and films and videos and guest speakers. But there's also Indigenous community involvement in that space, which is great.
Tell me about the art that you've created that's been inspired by Crawford Lake as a candidate site to mark the beginning of the great acceleration in the Anthropocene.
Well, I think, the whole of the show talks about all of the ways in which human beings interact with that site.
And the show you're talking
about? The show is Fire Over Water, which contains music, video, painting, installations, and written material. The primary piece, or the head painting, was actually the book cover for The Daughters of Atensic. So that started the process of thinking about the lake as a kind of, and the land around it as a landing point for Atensic, the woman who fell from above. And my clan is very much involved with her story because the little turtle made all the heavenly bodies for Sky Woman. Under that painting is an installation called The Bead Spitter. And there was a reference to Prosper Vincent, from who was a Wendat man, talking about a narrative, and we have very little of the narrative, about an old woman sitting in a canoe, and of course she's called a witch because that's what people do to old women. They call them witches. So she's sitting in a canoe, and she has a pipe, and she's drawing from the pipe, and as she exhales, she spits wampum out into her blouse and the canoe and the lake. And in talking with the scientists, I discovered through conversations with them that chrysophytes and diatoms have glass-like casings that are like beads. And so I envisioned the bead spitter sitting in the canoe. And by the way, there's a 16-foot-long vintage Wendat canoe suspended from the ceiling in the Deer Clan longhouse. So there she is, kind of in between the worlds again, spitting these beads out, which fall down to the bottom of the lake and land in striations. And these striations are the varves, or the core samples, but they are also the body of the lake, the earth that's under the lake, this Myrmictic lake. So the scientists are out there pulling the varves out of the bottom of the lake, and I was shown a varve, and I thought, well, that looks to me like rows of beads. And so I worked with a couple of young community members and had them weave a wampum belt, which consists of a replica of a varve, if you follow my drift.
I do. I was looking at it, and okay. you can see the... Yeah, it's kind of like it's like a core sample, except it's made out of beads.
Right, right. And they're also... Many of them are transparent to represent those glass casings that have fallen to the bottom of the lake and created these striations of matter. So I mounted the piece in a glass box and filled it with lake water. So it has the spirit and the water energy in it, and it is a core sample for all intents and purposes, but it represents a core sample from something else, from our culture, from the bead spitter's mouth.
It's fabulous that in that core sample, there are pollen grains and sediments down there. Talk about that. Talk about the three sisters and corn and beans and squash and what that means to you to know that there's actually a pollen is down there. I mean, it's testimony to the presence of First Nations people. Talk with
sure.
me about this.
On the bead spitter piece, there is one bead that is hanging from the belt. And it's separate from all the other beads, and it's yellow. And that is the corn pollen that was found under the lake. The Wendat needed a pound and a third of corn a day per person to survive. They ate a lot of plant material and game when it was available to them. They knew very well about medicines and how to survive in the natural world. They were expert farmers. They were quite incredible. Mm. The corn, beans, and squash have a uniquely interdependent relationship. The plant, the corn stalk, they're planted in sequences. The corn first, which grows, and then the beans, I believe, are planted next, and they spiral up that corn stalk, which supports them. And then the squash is planted, and all of those giant squash leaves cover the earth and protect the nitrates and all the other things, all the nutrients that are needed to keep those plants thriving. And they also used to embed, I think, part of a fish or fish protein to help fertilize those plants. When those plants are consumed together, they supply pretty well all the nutrition that a person, that a human body needs to sustain itself, which is quite incredible. So it has an iconic, as you say, relationship with indigenous people all over the Great Lakes region, and many people farmed corn, beans, and squash to survive, as well as sunchokes, which are the, I believe, the roots of the sunflower, which are also quite edible and quite delicious, and are growing in the medicine garden up at Crawford Lake. There are narratives about the three sisters and their interdependence on each other, which serve to remind us about how communities need to be interdependent or are interdependent and should rely on each other to create a whole community in support. You know, there's that expression, it takes a village. Well, it does take a village. And, you know, our people would have helped raise the children communally. Often father's brothers, I believe, would have been involved in their child rearing. The clan mothers would be busy, you know, kind of with their essential responsibilities in the community. Everybody contributed to the way in which the community created itself and thrived. And they did that at Crawford Lake. They did that in several longhouses, and they did that in layers over time. Different people, different, you know, spaces, different longhouses. They lived in community in several families in one longhouse, and corn, beans, and squash helped them to survive. They would dry the corn up in the rafters, and the young folks who could climb up those beams of the longhouses, which are very tall, would go up and grab the corn, and it would also keep it away from rodents and other beings who would like to share in the bounty.
The interesting thing about Crawford Lake and the sediments down there is that they have recorded human habits. I mean, they've recorded climatic changes. They've recorded changes in the atmosphere. They've recorded changes in the chemical composition of the surface waters of Crawford Lake. And they've recorded the presence of human beings. And down there, I don't know how many feet down, we find that layer, that set of varves that within which is recorded the presence of First Nations people, that gentle presence. But several inches above it, we've got the mid-20th century, where you've got plutonium and spherical carbonaceous particles that were emitted from the steelworks in Hamilton. Plutonium, radioactivity, and other noxious particles and things. Reflect on this for me.
The event of discovering plutonium in the lake, although it does help to signify our human presence, to me, it's tragic. It's tragic because of nuclear testing. It's tragic because of the damage that we've done to other people in the world and ourselves. And this ridiculous notion that we have that people who live on the other side of the world are kind of separated by some invisible boundary. Well, nuclear energy doesn't know any boundaries. What happens in Japan, you know, in 1945 is still affecting people in North America. What happened at Fukushima is still affecting people all over the world. What happened at Three Mile Island is still affecting people all over. So we're not separated. We're all one human family. Whether we're indigenous or indigenous to another land, there are indigenous people all over the world. And we all, I think, should mourn these indications of where we've really messed up and where we've made decisions that I think are flawed and that had great catastrophic effects on the people of the world. A kind of look at that varve as a sample of the passage of time and the cultivation of farmlands and the development of people and all of that kind of stuff and my ancestors in that territory. But I also look at it as kind of a stake driven through the heart of, you know, humanity because it has plutonium in it. You know, because we use these things to damage and hurt other people, and also in that process we damage and hurt the earth. One can't ignore that.
Right? So these varves are, in a sense, a form of knowledge. They convey knowledge, don't they?
Oh, yes. I mean, they're the varves are encyclopedia of knowledge, of kind of liminal knowledge of anthropological knowledge of farming practices and agrarian knowledge, and also the tremendously sad and profound realization that somewhere along those timelines that we've made decisions that have harmed people. So people who were trying to survive and living well and thriving, and other people who made decisions that have had catastrophic impacts on the world. And I also, Dr. McCarthy was very open to my suggesting to the scientists that at some point they should stop taking samples from the lake, because they have apparently quite a few varves have been taken out of the bottom of the lake. And, you know, I believe, as many Indigenous people do, that the lake contains a living spiritual energy that needs to be protected. And you're kind of digging into the core of Mother Earth, removing chunks of her, and, you know, having another impact on the ecosystem in the lake. It's time to kind of, you know, walk gently again, I think. We've gathered a lot of knowledge about the lake and about the Anthropocene through the lake, and I think it would be great if Crawford Lake was chosen as the Golden Spike location. It would be a tremendous opportunity for the sharing of knowledge around human impacts on the natural world. But I also think that the after effects of that have to be that we make better decisions about how we live in this world and how we connect with the natural world.
Catherine Tomorrow is a seated spotted turtle clan faith keeper and a Toronto artist. I'll post the link to Catherine's rendition of Crawford Lake Varves, her beet spitter creation, at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Shout out to CFMU and CKMS listeners in Hamilton and Waterloo, Ontario, and CKUW fans in Winnipeg. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Bird note. Many bird species have a distinctive song. But not every individual in the species sings exactly the same way. Usually, there are some features in common, certain patterns and phrases. But birds put their own spin on the species' theme tune. What's more, birds that live near each other sometimes have similar songs. If you visit one field with a few song sparrows, they often sound more like each other than a group of song sparrows living a few miles away. Scientists refer to this pattern as a song neighborhood. It's less like a regional dialect among people that's found over a large area. It's more local than that, like a group of friends copying each other's mannerisms. There may be advantages to birds copying their neighbor's way of singing. Researchers found that in song sparrow populations where birds had similar songs, birds were more likely to survive and hold on to their breeding territories. In other words, if one song is a hit during the breeding season, these sparrows keep singing it. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Support for BirdNote is provided by the Bobolink Foundation and generous listeners around the world.